it out. Oh, man, what? What happened? How could he be disappointed already? The game hadn't even started. Dad, this isn't a park. You said we were going to the park. He struggled through three innings and three more $10 hot dogs before we got the hell out of there. Dad and son Yankee game? Check. Broadway shows. Probably the most expensive thing you can do with your children in New York City is to take them to a Broadway show. We've seen The Lion King, Mary Poppins, Shrek, Annie twice, and Beauty and the Beast twice. The thing about having a bunch of kids is that you end up doing once-in-a-lifetime things more than once in a lifetime. Suddenly your new baby is four, and that show is still on Broadway, and now she wants to see it. Sometimes the snacks at intermission cost about as much as the overpriced ticket. I've yet to leave one of these shows and think, well, that was worth the money. Statue of Liberty. I'd lived in New York City 20 years and still hadn't seen Lady Liberty in person. I'd had friends from out of town come and visit, and they would always want to take the ferry and see the statue. No, thanks. Tell her I said hi. When they came back, my out-of-town friends would rave about the experience. Once I had children, I knew I had to take them to see what all the fuss was about. One Saturday morning, I had the brilliant idea that it would be a perfect day to visit the Statue of Liberty. I wrangled our then three kids down to the South Ferry Station, where the Statue of Liberty ferry departs. When we arrived, it became apparent that 10 zillion other people had the same brilliant idea. Realizing that my children were too young to notice the difference, we took the Staten Island ferry instead. My children were just as thrilled to go on a boat. I pointed as we passed the statue. There she is, Lady Liberty! I was a hero. Empire State Building. See Statue of Liberty, but replace Staten Island Ferry with a taxi cab. Through all my visits to these great places, I have learned that the one thing they all have in common that makes any of them worthwhile is that you are there with your kids spending quality time. That's the most important thing, quality time. The only other thing that could top this experience is quality time and a big pastrami sandwich. That would be quality time. Pale Force. If you have no idea what I look like, I'm a very pale person. My photo on the book cover was retouched to make the glare from my skin easier on your eyes. Hey, the publisher wanted to sell books. Trust me, I'm a very pale person. No, I'm paler than that. Yes, that pale. Even when I look in the mirror, I think, wow, I'm pale. I've never tanned. Growing up, I hated being pale. I was the whitest kid in an all-white community. Ironically, in a way, I was the minority. As a kid, I was called Whitey, Casper, Albino. Other kids would ask, why are you so pale? I realize this is a minor form of bullying compared to what some have gone through, but to the 10-year-old me, it was brutal. I felt like an outcast. I was the pale kid. I sometimes think that in addition to the influence of my father, I pursued being funny just to add an adjective before pale. I would be the funny pale kid. So when I was asked, why is your hair so white? I'd respond, because my father's a Q-tip. It got a laugh. It still hurt, but the laugh made it more bearable. Eventually, I embraced my paleness. I even learned to laugh at my paleness. Now imagine five miniature versions of me, but not as dark-skinned. During the summer, my children need sunscreen applied to them every 10 minutes, or they will die. I feel like I'm raising vampires. Don't open the fridge, you'll kill yourself! Prior to having children, I never went outside. Well, I never went outside to enjoy the outdoors. I guess I'm what you would consider indoorsy. I didn't even know what a long-sleeve sunshirt was or how humiliating it is to wear one. Now I'm a proud owner of two long-sleeve sunshirts, one for formal swimming pools and one for casual swimming pools. Let me tell you, there is no boost to the ego quite like putting sunscreen on the top of your balding head, but I think swimming in a pool in a long-sleeve sunshirt is up there. Wearing a long-sleeve sunshirt in a swimming pool makes it impossible to not look like a moron. People always seem to look at me like I fell in. Is that guy just swimming in his clothes? That's the worst suicide attempt I've ever seen. I suppose our family paleness is entertaining to the outside world, but it adds another thick white layer of difficulty to parenting that most people don't consider. Sunscreen. Whoever decided that the protective goo that pale people need to slather liberally on their skin should be white and actually make them look paler is just cruel. But that's only the first problem with sunscreen. To fully grasp the commitment that sunscreen demands from me, consider the following. I hope this will be an easy book to read. If you wanted to, I suppose you could read this book in a few hours. That is roughly the time it takes to properly apply sunscreen to one of my children. Now multiply that by 5. Now add in the fact that I have to sunscreen myself. Now you understand why I hate the summer. We're going to the beach next week. Well, I'd better start putting sunscreen on them now. True, we are Catholic, but I sometimes feel that it's the sunscreen industry that is more pleased that Jeannie and I have so many children. We must be dramatically increasing overall sales. It's not just the look, the cost, and the time involved in putting sunscreen on a child. It's the battle. My kids have no idea why they would have to wait to have fun while they are smeared with chemicals all over their face and body. They scream, they cry, "It burns!" The process of applying sunscreen just highlights the preposterousness of raising pale kids on a planet that revolves around a hot burning star that emits poisonous UV rays. I can never tell if the concerned looks from strangers are because they think I'm torturing my children or because I'm dressed like an out-of-shape Superman at the beach. Does anyone know where I can get a red swim cape? Learning them. Newborns arrive as a blank slate, a tabula rasa, or as I call them, dummies. Every parent must start from scratch and teach them everything. Kids have a whole lot of learning to do. Of course, not from me, because I also am a dummy. The apple does not fall far from that thing it grows on. Luckily, there are classes, activities, and of course, school. I really wasn't prepared for the amount of classes offered to little children. When I was a kid, there was only preschool and watching television. Now, the moment after conception, there are classes specifically geared towards your fetus. For example, there's prenatal yoga. It's a lot like regular yoga, but it has the word prenatal before it. Once your child is born, the classes for 1- and 2-year-olds run the gamut from pointless to useless. You are essentially paying an enormous amount of money to take your baby to some room in order to interact with them. Parents sit in a circle on the floor and sing horrible songs led by some well-intended struggling musician as the 2-year-olds run around the room screaming and try and hit each other with musical instruments that have been handed out. Toddler classes are no better. Toddler soccer is like watching a political discussion on cable news. It starts off serious and ends in embarrassment for all involved. "Wah, he stole my ball!" Yeah, Jack, that's the point of the game. Luckily, as your child gets older, the good people that run these classes continue to take advantage of parental enthusiasm and guilt. When she was 6, my daughter Mari was in a dance class that ended with a performance that parents had to pay $35 to get into. That's right, I had to pay to see my 6-year-old twirl around the stage for 5 minutes, dancing a routine she learned in a class I paid for her to attend. The experience was made complete when I opened a fundraising letter from the school the next week. Eventually, children start actual school. When I was single, I never understood those commercials with parents celebrating the end of summer. Now I understand that around mid-August, all the summer camps are over and you've run out of constructive things to do with your kid and you're desperate to get them out of the house. You've grown tired of your 4-year-old pointing to words and asking, "What does that say?" Apparently, it's not okay to respond with. It says, "Learn how to read." You don't want to get rid of your children, but you do want to get rid of them for a couple of hours a day. School seems like a perfect solution. Your precious child will learn something, and most important, you will be able to use the bathroom in peace. My only problem with school is when it starts and ends. Preschool boils down to a couple of hours in a day for you to run errands. Elementary school starts at the ungodly hour of 8 a.m. Yes, in the morning. Given that a first grader can't put on a t-shirt properly, they will need help at the even ungodlier hour of 7 a.m. Since I decided to raise an entire basketball team that can barely dress themselves, I have to wake up too. It's not just getting them to school. It's what they can and cannot bring with them. When I first moved to New York City, I remember hearing stories of little children bringing guns to elementary school. Thankfully, this trend is over, but it has been replaced by little children bringing far more dangerous weapons to school, such as the peanut butter sandwich. During the first weeks of school, there are emails and email reminders instructing parents that children are forbidden to bring anything containing nuts into the school. I realize a nut allergy is no joke, but I can't think of one child growing up that had a nut allergy. Now they are more common than Velcro sneakers. Today it seems every other child has a nut allergy. Sometimes I think, why don't they just open a school for children without nut allergies? I am all for small class size. There was one paranoid teacher at our nursery school that would check the children's backpacks as they came in to make sure no one smuggled in anything produced in the facility that may have possibly also produced something containing a trace of nuts or something that sounded like nuts. That sounds nuts, right? I was less shocked that they were checking the backpacks than I was shocked that nursery students had backpacks. Why a 3-year-old would need a backpack is beyond me, but my daughter Katie has one too. She has nothing in there. She'll wear her backpack for a couple of minutes and then hand it off to me to carry up the stairs to her classroom. She has a kid in her classroom who has a backpack with wheels on it. Yes, wheels. That way, when the child gets tired of carrying the things they don't need to nursery school, they can roll the bag of nothing around. Perfect. I love the preschools that my children have attended, but they are not really schools, and this applies to all of them. No matter whether they are called a preschool, a nursery, or an early learning center, they are either just a daycare or a jail. That's why I find it strange that they still hold parent-teacher conferences. The preschool parent-teacher conferences always feel like a game of serial killer and not serial killer. You either find out your child is dismembering dolls or not dismembering dolls. This is not to say you don't learn insightful things about your child. Your daughter likes to sing and loves the color green. Or, see their artwork. This is what your daughter scribbled last week, and this is what she scribbled this week. Of course you want to hear your child is doing well and getting along with other children, but unless your child is building bombs or purposely urinating in the quiet corner, the parent-teacher conference for a nursery student is incredibly pointless and can be done over email. Even as your child gets older, the parent-teacher conference is always a strange experience. The conference is supposed to be all about the child, but somehow it ends up with you feeling like you are getting a report card on your parenting. You still want to know your child is doing well, and you still want to see their work. But because I'm an actor and a comedian, it seems that these conferences always lead back to my occupation. Well, your daughter or son is very dramatic and loves to talk, which I guess is no surprise given your occupation. I'm not offended, but the implication that all improper behavior is the result of what I do for a living is rather absurd, as if a chatty 5-year-old with a librarian mom would be a red flag. We expected your child to sit behind her desk and shush people. Maybe she needs Ritalin. A self-portrait. Sometimes I feel like I could spend my whole day dropping off and picking up my children, and frankly, I do. No, really, I do. I'm writing this right now on the subway after I dropped off my daughters at school. I tell you, some of the looks you get on the New York City subway, people act like they've never seen a typewriter before. This time-sucking parenting task is made even more complicated in New York City without a car. My kids are really going to be surprised to find out I'm charging them for all these back and forths. I belong in New York City, but I don't fit in New York City. I've lived in New York City for over 20 years, and I'm still treated like a tourist. I've had more than one cab driver ask me, "Where are you visiting from?" I always sense they're trying to take advantage of the tourist. I could be going 5 blocks and I'll have cab drivers ask if I'd like to take the George Washington Bridge. Yes, can we also swing by LaGuardia Airport and pick up some groceries since I'm naive because I have blonde hair? I've lived in New York City long enough to forget how truly white bread I look. Occasionally I'll be on the subway and I'll see some tourists from Iowa and I'll think to myself, check out those people. Oh wait, that's exactly what I look like. At this point, I'm comfortable not really fitting in anywhere in New York City. I'm not a hipster, I'm not a Wall Street guy, I'm not one of the fashionable, and I'm not even one of the anti-fashionable fashionables. I feel most comfortable among the homeless and the oddball characters on the Bowery. Of course, having our children go to school near the Bowery would be too easy. One year, we had 2 babies at home and 2 children at 2 different schools. Wait, it gets better. These 2 schools were in completely different parts of the city, and each provided their own special form of awkwardness for me. Mari was and is still attending a fancy all-girls Catholic school on the Upper East Side. The school building is a former Vanderbilt mansion, think Madeline, and roughly as far away from our home on the Bowery as well Paris, France is from the Bowery. The school is a warm, amazing place populated by the daughters of the titans of finance and industry. The girls wear adorable light blue uniforms and occasionally stand in two straight lines. When I go for drop-off or pickup, I'm usually the only parent in jeans wearing a baseball cap. I probably look unshowered because often I am. The other parents are very nice, but I usually feel that for some reason I'm being treated as the strange downtowner who tells jokes for a living. Oh, wait, I guess I am. Our second oldest, Jack, was attending an amazing play-based school in the East Village. I still don't exactly know what play-based means, but I just remember the classroom not having any chairs and me being one of the only parents without a tattoo or a child named after a spice. Housed in a turn-of-the-century brownstone, the school felt a little like the beacon to 19th-century street kids it once was. The other parents were very nice, but for some reason I usually felt like I was being treated as the strange white bread guy who tells jokes for a living. Oh wait, I guess I am. Given that I'm more of an afternoon guy than a morning guy, I often do the pickup portion of the round trip. I would usually get Jack first in the East Village, then make the trek to the Upper East Side to get Mari. Every afternoon, I would enter the basement-slash-locker-room-area-slash-greeting-area of Jack's school and check out the artwork the children had made hanging on the walls while I waited. It always feels a little generous calling a preschool's artwork, artwork. One afternoon, I was looking at the self-portraits of the pre-K class drawn on yellow construction paper. In one handcrafted picture, there was a toilet paper roll jutting out of the top area of the legs. I chuckled to an ironic T-shirt fedora-wearing father. That looks like a penis. The father looked at me like I had just canceled PBS funding. What's wrong with that? I don't know. Everything? At that point, Jack arrived with his teacher. Oh, you saw Jack's artwork. I did. It's my penis. I recognized it. We encourage the kids to express themselves about their bodies without any shame or guilt. Good, good. You're welcome to take it home. Oh, I can't wait to show Jack's mom. As we taxied up to the Upper East Side, Jack held his penis artwork on his lap and told me about his day. Well, actually, I asked him about his day, and he said he didn't remember anything. At Mari's school, we waited with the other moms for dismissal in the grand lobby of the former mansion. Often, pickups at Mari's school feel like I'm just conducting a press conference for Jeannie while stopping Jack from climbing on the grand staircase. Where's Jeannie? How's Jeannie? Why aren't you Jeannie? While fielding questions from the mom press on that particular day, I turned and saw the head of Mari's school greeting Jack. How are you, Jack? Great. Want to see my penis? Two pickups, two sides of town, two equal doses of awkwardness. I scurried my children out of the mansion, down onto Fifth Avenue and into a cab. A half hour later, we arrived in front of our building on the Bowery. I give Mari and Jack each a quarter so that they can get a gumball from the gumball machine outside of Patricia Field's boutique, the gumball machine conveniently located between two mannequins in full S&M garb. As I wait for the kids, my friend, the six-foot bearded drag queen, Andre, greets me. Hey, Jim. Hey, Andre. There's no place like home. Your special day. When you have a child, a really fun thing to do is to throw them birthday parties. The first baby's first birthday is an unforgettable event. Normally during the first year of your first baby's life, you and your wife will not go out and party like you used to, ever. You are busy being consumed with figuring out the new baby thing, and you really don't feel comfortable leaving the baby with anyone else. You barely see your friends during that first baby's first year, so by the time the first birthday rolls around, you are really ready for a party. The first baby's first birthday party is not a party for your baby. It's a party for you. Sure, the baby will someday appreciate the photo of them in front of the cake with the one candle and the photo of them taking their first bite of cake, but when a baby turns 12 months old, they really have no idea that they are even at a party or that the party is actually for them because their entire life seems like a party for them. Everything is always new and exciting, they're always the center of attention, and to them most people look like clowns anyway. Except for the photo, it really doesn't matter if a baby is even at their first birthday party. They wouldn't even notice if you didn't throw them a party at all. You are the one that needs the party. The baby obviously has no friends, so the guest list is all your friends you haven't seen for a year. And since your friends are the guests, they will obviously need good food, good drinks, and music. And suddenly you have the recipe for a raging bash, and you take the pictures of your baby in front of the cake, put them to bed, and carry on like, well, like you don't have a baby. Even after that first baby's first birthday party, you still love throwing your kids' birthday parties. You remember how exciting your birthday parties were as a kid. Even if it was just your mom taking you and a few friends to that disgusting McDonald's indoor playground, it was still the time of your life. You want your kid to have that experience too, so you throw them a fun birthday party, and guess what? All the evil, greedy businesses out there know you want to do it, and they see it as a wonderful way to take advantage of your desire to rekindle your childhood memories and throw your kid a fun birthday party by robbing you blind. You will soon find out that every chain restaurant, children's museum, skate rink, bowling alley, toy store, and gymnastics club will offer birthday party packages to save you the trouble of having all the kids over to your place for the small fee of $100 billion. A small price to pay for all the cheap, plastic, toxic, made-in-China, unnecessary gifts that other kids' parents picked up on the way to the party that you are just going to end up re-gifting when your kid gets invited to one of their friends' parties. If your own kids' birthday parties are fun, double that on how unfun other people's kids' birthday parties are. Because most 2 to 6-year-olds don't drive or even know their own address, an adult will most likely also have to attend other kids' parties with them. Given that my family has roughly the same population as South Dakota, I've already been to too many other kids' birthday parties. Other people's children's birthday parties are the most joyful events you will ever resent having to attend. The reality of the sheer quantity of birthday parties you will be attending kicks in around kindergarten. It will seem like every kid in your children's class has a birthday party at least once a year. Can you believe that? Birthday parties trickle in and take over like an infestation of termites eating away at your Saturday. They're in strange locations and at inconvenient times. My daughter Mari was invited to a birthday party that started at 9 a.m. on Saturday. Yes, 9 a.m. means morning, and Saturday means weekend. I actually thought it was a joke at first. I found myself asking Mari questions like, how good of a friend are you with this strange Audrey girl? Wouldn't you rather watch cartoons on Saturday morning? How much would someone have to pay you not to go to this party? I was ready to tell Mari that Saturday parties before noon were against our religion until Jeannie agreed to go. Attending a birthday party for a little kid can be pretty awkward, especially if you weren't invited. Sometimes you aren't invited. Just your child is. These parties are called drop-offs, where you leave your children in the care of some frazzled stranger at a Build-A-Bear workshop, and you walk off with just enough time to do nothing except be that creepy guy wandering around a mall with a Diet Coke being tailed by a suspicious security guard until you have to pick up your face-painted sugar-hide puddle of a child. Even if you only have 1 or 2 kids, by the time they are in grade school, you have brought them to so many birthday parties it will become somewhat of a routine. After coaxing your child into crafting something resembling a card and taping it onto the poorly wrapped, re-gifted present from their own birthday party, you rush the overexcited kid wearing their favorite outfit out the door, and you are on your way to the party. Then you realize that you forgot the re-gift, so you run back to get it, and now you are late and your kid is furious at you because they feel they have now missed the funnest part. Upon arrival at the venue, your child runs away immediately, and you are left awkwardly holding your embarrassing present, praying that it is not originally from the kid whose birthday party it is, making small talk with parents you barely know, and trying to get through the conversation without revealing that you totally forgot their name and you don't know who their kid is. After some games no one wants to participate in, some ugly, glue-dribbled craft your kid makes that you plan on tossing into the first dumpster you see on the way home, and the inevitable pizza, it's time for cake. The cake is the fat lady singing of the little kid birthday party, the final act, the climax of the birthday party, what everyone has been waiting for. Kids love cake, and who can blame them? Everyone loves cake. But at other kids' birthday parties, you also love cake for what it represents. The end. The time to go home. You are officially excused to leave the birthday party after the cake. It's the last hymn at church. Sometimes the much-anticipated exit takes a little longer because the cake has ice cream to go with it. I'm always amazed how we serve ice cream with cake at little kids' birthday parties. Hey, you know what would be really good with this sugar bread? Some frozen sugar milk. Now let's give it to the 4-year-olds and see how they respond. Sugar doesn't affect children, right? We're about to hand them back to the care of their parents anyway. And just as you are exiting the party with your tearful, screaming, pre-diabetic child over your shoulder, you are handed exactly what you need for the way home. A treat bag filled with candy. I'm pretty sure this is the formula that was used to prepare the young Linda Blair for filming the bed scene in The Exorcist. Losing my religion. Anyone who has ever taken their babies and kids to church, a temple, a mosque, a wedding, a funeral, or any other place of reverence understands the true meaning of torture. Obviously, I'm against torture, yet I still take my kids to church. The question remains, who am I really torturing? Am I torturing myself because it's virtually impossible to get a young child to sit still and listen to some old guy go on and on about metaphors they don't understand? Am I torturing my children because church is the opposite of a video game? Am I torturing the innocent churchgoers sitting around me trying to listen and being distracted by my kids climbing on the pews or playing peekaboo with them? The answer is all of the above. I empathize with my children. If you've never been to a Catholic Mass, don't worry. It's still going on. You still have time to catch it. I remember when I was a kid, I really thought the church was 8 hours long. At times, it feels like they're dragging church out on purpose. Amen. I remember thinking, amen already. Let's wrap it up, Padre. I got some sinning to do. It was too early, too boring, smelled weird, and was filled with the oldest people on the planet. How did you get here? What was Jesus like as a kid? I used to have to do readings in church, and it was terrifying. I would never have my glasses. The words are printed so small, even Superman would be nervous. And you're reading from the Bible. It's not like you can just make something up and improvise. A reading from the letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians. Dear Corinthians, how was your weekend? Sure is hot here. Tell Jesus, hey, this is the word of the Lord. When I was growing up, just getting to church caused such anxiety in our home, it seemed to defeat the purpose. Sunday mornings, my dad would bark, hurry up, or we're going to be late for church, goddammit. At that age, church to me was all about strict obedience, uncomfortable clothes, and memorization. I remember my father glaring at me during Mass to see if I knew my prayers. Even now I find myself dreading going to Mass. It's not just the battle with the kids. God really should have talked to the NFL before deciding to put church on Sunday. Family church on Sunday is all Jeannie's idea. Even if there's no way my kids can figure out what's going on in there, Jeannie insists that the routine and the exposure to it will someday benefit them. Jeannie is very Catholic. She is like a Shiite Catholic. She's already received her early admissions to heaven. I can never get Jeannie to leave church after Mass. Why don't we stay and talk to the weirdest people here? There are definitely some serious crazies at church. Whenever I meet a real nut job at church, I am always grateful that they are going to church. Imagine how crazy they would be if they didn't have rules to follow. Yes, I take my children to church because I, too, am one of those crazies. Kids are way too noisy for church, and everyone reminds you of that while your children are acting up and turning their heads around to look at you. This, in turn, makes everyone else turn their head around to look at you, as if looking at you is somehow going to make your kids behave instead of just making you feel horrible. No matter how much talking or singing there is at church, kids always find that brief moment of silence to make a loud announcement. Michael did a poopy in his diaper. Also, if you take your kid to the bathroom at church one time, every time you take them to church, they will constantly tell you they have to go to the bathroom. They don't need to go to the bathroom. They just need a break from church. And they know you have to take them. They know you live in fear of saying no because that one time you do say no will be the one time they actually do need to go to the bathroom, and then you will be really up that creek you can't talk about in church. So you continue to take them to the bathroom, and deep down you don't mind because you also need a break from church. Then there is the spectacle of carrying your misbehaving child out of church and taking them to the back until they quiet down. This is another dilemma, because taking them to the back is actually a reward for them, and it just encourages them to misbehave more often. I don't want them to view church as punishment. I do see the value in routine, tradition, and family time. I have tried to give them positive associations with going to church by offering the kids a treat after church as an incentive to behave. If you are good in church, we'll go out for pancakes. This also backfires because once you mention pancakes, that's all they are going to think about and therefore talk about during the entirety of the church service. Is it time for pancakes yet? Can I have syrup on my pancakes? Are there chocolate chip pancakes? To a parishioner, we're going for pancakes. There is no way your small child is going to have a spiritual experience at church. The only times I have ever had a spiritual experience at church are when my kids were not at church. I think that I may have even heard the voice of God say, "Thank you for not bringing your kids to church." No such thing as a free babysitter. When you first have a baby, it seems like all your friends, siblings, and even sometimes strangers want to help. "Hey, if you ever need someone to babysit, let me know." It actually appears as if everyone is begging to watch your kids. What a relief. It takes a village, right? A short time later, you will realize that in reality, no one wants to babysit or even help at all. They just want to say they offered. Offering is the kind gesture. Fine, whatever. I don't need your help anyway. Besides, I wouldn't want some weirdo or relative watching my new baby. I am the parent, and I'm not looking to outsource, thank you. I'm an American, buddy. Eventually, the need for a babysitter creeps in as sneakily as reality TV took over and ruined prime time. Inevitably, you are forced to give up the naive belief that you will be with your child every moment of their life. You need help. The question is, who should watch your angel? Who could ever be worthy of that all-important task of sitting in your apartment while your child sleeps? The go-to is your parents. You know they are not serial killers. They want to see their grandchild, and you don't want to pay anyone. The perfect situation. The problem is, when you are not paying someone to do a favor for you, they don't really need to listen to you. No candy means your heartless parents don't give you candy, so I will give you tons of candy, so you will like me better than your parents. Also, your mom and dad are crazy. They raised you, and you are a disaster. By letting them watch your kids, you are giving them free rein to replicate their mistakes. To make matters worse, by the time your parents are grandparents, they are not equipped to deal with children. I know my parents wouldn't be good at babysitting, mostly because they've been dead for a decade. Actually, they might be better at it now, do less damage. Initially, letting someone that is not you or your spouse watch your child is nerve-wracking. You check in, remind them to pay attention, and eventually you cut your obligation short to race home to your newborn. The free babysitters are brief. You go through your parents, your siblings, and the rare friend who is not an alcoholic. You then must hire some stranger to watch your prized possessions and also your kids. See what I did there? Kind of funny, right? Well, I thought it was. Choosing a babysitter that is not a family member is one of the real struggles of parenting. Who to hire? Are they attentive? Do they have a criminal record? Eventually, you become more lax in your approach. Do you have a pulse? We'll be home around 10. Of course, I'm joking, kind of. With more children comes a greater need for help. As you add more and more children to the mix, the price goes up as the babysitting pool diminishes, and you become more efficient at selecting a babysitter. For instance, the necessity of speaking English shrinks dramatically. The following is an actual conversation I had with a babysitter. "Jim, this is Zanga." "Oh, nice to meet you. Where are you from?"
"Yes."
What country are you from?"
"Yes."
"She's from Sri Lanka." "Oh, Sri Lanka. That's where the Tamil Tigers are from, right?"
"Yes. Tsunami. Very sad."
"Well, thanks for helping out, Zanga."
"Very sad."
Very sad. I wish I was exaggerating. We once had a non-English-speaking babysitter from Guatemala who I'm pretty sure didn't even speak Spanish. Someone who doesn't know English shouldn't be watching my children, you say. In any small business like parenting five children, it is necessary that you place the right people where their assets can be most useful in order to run a successful operation. Sometimes all the training a babysitter needs is having been a good mother herself. I don't care if some early childhood education grad student has taken 12 infant CPR classes. It will never replace the experience of a sitter who has raised her own well-adjusted children. No English is required for this position. Let me familiarize you with some of my other categories of babysitters. The warm body. I never said these categories would be flattering. When you have 5 kids, it's completely necessary to have a warm body to sit at your house while you are gone for a short while. When children are asleep, we have no problem leaving them with a warm body sitting in our living room while we go out and do shows in Manhattan for a couple hours. They are literally a babysitter. Well, when they are not going through our stuff. The college student. This type of sitter is ideal for pickups and drop-offs because they know the New York City subway system, and your kids think they are some cool aunt from the Disney Channel. However, if you try to leave them with your kids at night, be prepared to pay $18 an hour for someone who will be texting their boyfriend constantly, and your computer history will show that they were checking in on Facebook more often than checking in on your kids. You will likely come home to an empty fridge and a sink full of dishes, and they will ditch you for the first unpaid NYU student film they can book. The Manny. Initially, I was hesitant to have another man babysit my kids. What if he is better with my kids than I am? What if he is worse with my kids than I am? I've grown to love it. It's really awesome to have a guy watch your kids. He can carry the stroller and a kid up 5 flights with no complaint and will keep them outside and active all day. You will not care at all that he does not clean or organize the diaper bag, because after all, he's a dude. Just the fact that he is a guy that can stand being around other people's kids is amazing to me. The Mary Poppins. It was love at first sight when you saw this babysitter interacting with other kids at the park. You immediately poached her from the family she was working for by offering her more money. This babysitter does it all. She's warm and reads stories and plays dress-up and cooks and cleans and is part teacher, part best friend. She knows all the names of the different X-Men. Your kids love her, and she will eventually get poached by a richer family at the park. Karma. Note, if you met your wife while she was married to another man, history is bound to repeat itself. The blackmailer. This babysitter will be amazing at first, and you will keep increasing her responsibilities. You will become completely dependent on her, and she will be an integral part of your daily routine and schedule. Inevitably, she will get involved in gossiping with other sitters at the park and find out that someone makes more money for fewer kids or gets a Metro card or federal holidays off when there is no school and you need someone the most. Then when you have your busiest week with your most important deadline, she will threaten to quit unless she immediately receives all the aforementioned perks, and you are forced to give in on all her demands. Of course, she will always hold one of the demands back and save it for the next time you are in a position of weakness. The attention seeker. This babysitter will always be going through some personal crisis and make you feel as if you somehow had something to do with it. They will interrupt you during a business phone call to inform you that they found some mess that your kid made instead of just cleaning it up. They will create drama with any other babysitter that you hire to fill in when you need someone extra. The attention seeker will have some really positive attributes to justify you keeping her around, but eventually it becomes too much to bear. Because your kids are also attention seekers, and there is not enough attention to go around as it is. The irony of the babysitting situation is that you need someone to watch your kids while you go out to earn the money to pay someone to take care of your kids. Your ultimate goal by earning the money is to be able to spend quality time with your kids, which is what you are paying your babysitter to do. The babysitter thing is my own personal Sisyphus story of endlessly rolling the rock up the hill and watching it roll back down. It's actually your fault, really, because you made me write this book so you could listen to it. How selfish of you. How to put 5 kids to bed in a 2-bedroom apartment. Living in a tiny 2-bedroom apartment with 5 children makes bedtime a logistical nightmare. We have 2 single beds in the kids' room and 1 king in our master bedroom. No, these aren't big rooms. Think bread box, but smaller. There is a crib in each of these rooms and also a crib on prominent display in the middle of our living room slash office slash dining room slash kitchen because we love to show off our crib. Pun intended. We have 3 cribs. We have so many cribs we should be on that show Cribs, or at least in pun jail. Given the number of children we have, bedtime must occur in waves. Babies, newborn and one-year-old, are placed in cribs, one in the kids' room and one in the master. Then the hard part commences, the coordinating of teeth brushing and using the bathroom with the big three. Once teeth are cleaned and everyone uses the potty, there is cuddling and stories with the big three, and then out of necessity, the most raucous one is temporarily placed in our bed in the master, which has now become the holding cell. If you're keeping track at home, we have three kids in one room and two in the other. Now you may be wondering, why don't we have bunk beds? We learned with our first two kids that bunk beds are great, except when a two-year-old crawls up to the top bunk, jumps, and falls on her face. We finally got rid of the bunk beds when we started to be on a first-name basis with the receptionist at the ER. Back to the present scenario. After the kids are in their secure location, I will run out and do a show or two. Jeannie will do whatever she does to hold our lives together. This part of the evening is known as quasi-intermission. After I come back, Act Two begins. Jeannie and I will do work right and try to maintain some semblance of a grown-up relationship. This all takes place in the living room, where there are no kids. As you can see, we have made optimal use of the apartment. We have all the children snug in each of our beds. You may wonder where Jeannie and I sleep since all the beds are occupied. This could be a major conflict. Begin Act Three. If Jeannie and I plan to read or watch television in bed, which is every night, by the way, then a transfer must occur. The child that is in our bed must be moved into one of the singles with one of the other kids. Then the baby that is in our room must be moved from the crib in our room to the crib that is in the now quiet and dark living room slash dining room slash office slash kitchen. Then Jeannie and I can watch TV or read for exactly 1 minute before they all wake up and come in our bed. Curtain. So how do we have time to make all these babies, you might ask? Well, that's none of your business, you pervert. Why don't you go reread that dirty book with the tie on the cover? I can't believe you read that stuff. Scandalous. I'm sorry, maybe I'm overreacting. I'm grateful you bought my non-dirty book. You obviously are a good person with some naughty secrets. I won't hold your creepiness against you. Negotiating with terrorists. Exactly 1 million years ago, there was a television show called The Waltons. Each episode of The Waltons would end with an exterior shot of the Waltons' home at nighttime. The camera would hold on the house as the family said their round robin of good nights as the lights in the windows went out. Each person in the family would chime in, "Good night, Mama. Good night, Daddy. Good night, Jim Bob. Good night, John Boy." This would go on for about a minute. It was adorable, it was sweet, and probably the most unrealistic portrayal of bedtime for parents ever displayed in any art form. Of course, bedtime is a misleading term. It should be categorized with the word utopia. Bedtime gives the impression that your children will be in bed going to sleep at a specific time. Any parent of a five-year-old will tell you that this is not a plausible reality. Bedtime with young children is a nightly crisis. Part of me is relieved that most of my shows coincide with bedtime, and therefore I have a valid excuse to remove myself from this catastrophic paradox. Bedtime makes you realize how completely incapable you are of being in charge of another human being. My children act like they've never been to sleep before. Bed? What's that? No, I'm not doing that. They never want to go to bed. This is another thing I will never have in common with my children. Every morning when I wake up, my first thought is, when can I come back here? It's the carrot that keeps me motivated. Sometimes going to bed feels like the highlight of my day. Ironically, to my children, bedtime is a punishment that violates their basic rights as a human being. Once the lights are out, you can expect at least an hour of inmates clanging their tin cups on the cell bars. They turn against us in a unified protest as fervent as the civil rights marches of the 1960s. This is unfair! Before the pajama burning begins, we move quickly into action following the divide-and-conquer strategy. Part of our bedtime ritual involves Jeannie and I lying down with our kids. We'll cuddle them, read to them, tell them stories, and eventually beg them to sleep. This strategy always begins as a wonderful, intimate experience, and then ends with threats and tears. And sometimes the kids get upset, too. Inevitably, it becomes a hostage negotiation, but in reverse. If you stay in there, we will give you whatever you want. What do you need, a helicopter to Cuba? We will meet all your demands if you just stay in there and don't hurt anyone. With five little kids, there's no ending to bedtime. There is always one awake, like they are taking shifts. I imagine they have scheduling meetings. All right, Illinois Dad, from midnight to 2, who wants the 3 to 6 shift? Now everyone lie down and practice kicking Dad in your sleep. Whenever one of my children says, goodnight, Daddy, I always think to myself, you don't mean that. My former bed. I love my bed. It was a big investment. It's a Tempur-Pedic. You may have seen one of their annoying commercials on television where the overly excited Tempur-Pedic owners make the appeal. Ask me about my Tempur-Pedic. Ask me how fast I fall asleep. I just want to chime in. Ask me why my Tempur-Pedic is filled with a horde of children every morning and I'm so uncomfortable. This is because my bed, our bed, is a family bed. There are two philosophies when it comes to getting young children to sleep. There is sleep training, which basically involves putting your kids to bed and listening to them scream all night. Or there is attachment parenting, which essentially involves lying down with your kids, cuddling them, and then listening to them scream all night. The family bed is an additional aspect of attachment parenting. Since Jeannie is a big believer in attachment parenting, and I'm a spineless coward, we have instituted an open-door policy, meaning if one of our kids has a nightmare, they are welcome to come in our room and pee in our bed. Luckily, this only happens every night. I don't know if you've ever slept next to someone that has wet the bed, but it's delightful. You're asleep, right? So when you wake up, your first thought is, oh my God, I wet the bed. For me, the next thought is, well, it's not that wet. I'll just scoot over a bit, and if I act like I'm sleeping, maybe Jeannie will change the sheets. Some of my finest acting has been pretending to be asleep while Jeannie cleans up the mess. I'll groggily comment, oh, I didn't notice that. Hey, while you're up, can you make me a sandwich? Sometimes I'm awake when one of my kids will stumble into my room. I'll be innocently watching TV when I catch a shadowy figure in my bedroom doorway out of the corner of my eye. It always scares the hell out of me. They'll just be standing there, blankly staring like they should be holding a knife. After I ask if they're okay, they'll climb in our bed and proceed to complain that I have the TV on. Turn off the TV, my 6-year-old son Jack will whine, like I'm interrupting him. Why don't you just go back to your own bed? Dad, turn it off, I'm trying to sleep. He's mostly upset because I'm watching the news. TV news is like kryptonite to children. The two major shifts in taste for children to adulthood are news and mustard. Kids hate news and mustard. Now, mustard even has the word turd in it. Maybe I should threaten my kids that if they don't go to bed, I will force them to watch an hour-long newscast about mustard. I love the fact that if our children wake up scared or are feeling lonely, they can come in our bed. I just wish each and every one of them didn't do it every single night. There isn't room. I'm not exaggerating. There are 7 people in my family, and there is yet to be a bed created in which we can all comfortably fit. I have a king-size bed, yet my domain is relegated to a sliver on the right edge. One more peasant revolt, and I'll be on the floor. By the end of the night, I find myself longing for my own cot. It could be made of nails, but it would be my own. I blame Dr. Sears, the advocate of attachment parenting, for this. Obviously, I love all the intentions of attachment parenting, but often attachment parenting seems to be a synonym for dad will be uncomfortable parenting. At this point, I'm in too deep. I can't just decide now that kids aren't allowed in the bed. The younger ones will hold it against me. I could just see the therapy session. Dad used to let the older kids sleep in the bed because he loves them way more. That's okay. Your dad is burning in hell right now. Oh, what a relief. I don't want my kids to want me to burn in hell. I just want my bed back. Jeannie never seems to be bothered by crowding. She would be comfortable under a blanket of children. Live children, of course. Morning has been broken. I love sleep. I need sleep. We all do, of course. There are those people that don't need sleep. I think they're called successful. For me, it's always a little sad getting out of bed. Every morning after I get up, I always gaze longingly at my bed and lament, "You were wonderful last night. I didn't want it to end. I can't wait to see you again." I am sure everyone hearing this book values their sleep, but I am a sleep enthusiast. My dream is to become one of those grandpas in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory who just lives in bed. That looked awesome. There aren't many things that I let interfere with my sleep. Have you ever been asleep at night and you hear a noise you're convinced is a murderer trying to break in your house and kill you, but instead of getting up and escaping, you just go back to bed? I guess the reasoning is they can't kill me if I'm asleep. I suppose that would be a pretty embarrassing way to die. That would create an awkward moment in heaven. How'd you die?
Oh, I was too lazy to get out of bed. Yeah, I heard the guy in the kitchen. I thought I had an hour.
Well, you're lazy. How'd they let you in here?
My wife got me in. She's over in the VIP section. Well, I should get back to cleaning up before I have to head back down to hell.
Sleep is too important. Sleep can make you give up any principle. Want to help the homeless? Sure, I'll help the homeless. Meet us Saturday morning at 7 a.m.
Forget the homeless. I mean, they're homeless in the afternoon, too, right? Besides, I think they're big brunch people.
I used to have to negotiate with myself just to get out of bed. All right, here's the deal, me. I'll get up, but I'm not taking a shower. I may be coming back here any minute.
I used to hear the alarm in the morning, and think, I could just get used to that. I'll just dream I'm in a techno club.
I gave up my relationship with sleep a long time ago. We had to break up, even though neither of us wanted to.
What came between us?
Kids.
Isn't that always the case? My kids were against me and sleep from the get-go.
They gave me an ultimatum, us or sleep. Before I had time to make up my mind, sleep walked out on me and never came back. Someone should write a country song about it. Sleep left me with full custody of my children. I'm usually awakened by a foot in my gut or in my face, or a foot in my gut and a foot to my face. The result is I'm tired all the time. Even complaining how tired I am exhausts me. I'm so tired that the other day I tried to open my front door with my wallet. Given how resistant children are to going to bed, I'm not surprised that they wake up so early. It's not just that they wake up early, it's how they wake up. I think morning means speak louder in little kid language. My son does not address me in a whisper or even a normal voice. He bellows 3 inches from my ear, like we are 400 feet apart. For some reason, all my children speak the loudest in the morning. Of course, sometimes Jeannie will get up with the kids and let me sleep. But the volume combined with the morning propensity toward temper tantrums makes this generous offer of letting me sleep an oxymoron. We have tried letting them stay up a little later so they sleep longer in the morning, but they just wake up more tired, more cranky, and as a result, more loud. The song goes, morning has broken. And I'm pretty sure my children broken. Like everything else they break, if they did break it, they'll never admit to it. I can just hear my kids' explanation.
Morning was already broken, Dad.
Really?
Yeah, we just came out here and it was broken.
I don't know what's more exhausting about parenting, the getting up early or acting like you know what you're doing. Sure, when I was single, I had to occasionally get up early for work, and it was a crisis.
Jim, you have to get up next Tuesday at 7 a.m.
Oh, no! I should go to bed now!
When you have kids, there's a whole different element of crisis. You are not only waking up sleep-deprived, but now you are also sleep-deprived and in charge of another human being. Not only are they absurdly loud in the morning, they are also ravenously hungry. Dad, I'm starving. Go back to bed, it's too early. But I need to eat or I'll die. Suddenly they turn into Oliver at the orphanage. Great, now if I don't get up, I'm neglecting the basic needs of my child. Since Jeannie was against my brilliant idea of pouring cereal into dog bowls the night before, I have to get up and feed my kids. Time, 6 a.m.
Daddy, we want pancakes.
What? Who? You want what?
Pancakes.
Great. He wants pancakes, and I feel like a pancake. It seems to me that if you're not old enough to make breakfast, you really should not be allowed to get up before 7 a.m. Of course, it doesn't feel like just getting up. It feels like punishment for every time in your life you complained about being bored. Now you are faced with the challenge of finding something in the house that they want to eat. They may be starving when they wake you up, but then they will complain about everything you try to give them. Sometimes I'll make scrambled eggs for my kids, which usually barely get eaten.
They're too runny. What is that? Cheese? Ew. Is there egg in this?
I thought you were starving.
I am, but not for that.
Unless it's Easter baskets or at IHOP, your little beggars become very choosy. Left to their own devices, they would probably just grab a bag of sugar and a spoon.
Once Mari, 6 at the time, made breakfast for herself and her brother and her little sister. She woke us up and proudly announced, "You don't have to get up. I made breakfast for me, Jack, and Katie." When I asked her why she had chocolate on her face, she explained that she had breakfast dessert. When I went out to the kitchen, it looked like a tornado had hit a frosting factory. Since Jeannie is usually breastfeeding a baby at this time of the morning, I normally get blamed for these natural disasters. "What happened out here?" "The kids made breakfast dessert. Have fun cleaning it up." Most mornings, it feels like it takes more than a village. Naps are payday loans. Given my passion for sleep, it is no surprise how I feel about naps. I believe in naps. I like to think of naps as a nonverbal way of saying to life, "I quit. I'm sitting this part of the day out." I understand that naps are usually reserved for babies and old people, but I don't discriminate. Naps used to be an integral part of my everyday life. Prior to children, a catastrophe for me was when I would sleep so late in the morning that I would miss my nap. As a new parent, I was pleased to discover that newborns take a lot of naps. It seems like they nap more than they are awake. Newborns nap so much you'd think they were on drugs or depressed. Always looking to contribute, I'll often selflessly offer to help get one of our babies to sleep. Sometimes I'll nap with our 15-month-old son to be supportive. Sometimes I'll nap with our newborn to be supportive. Sometimes I'll nap alone in homage to our newborn and our 15-month-old. It's all about putting kids first, really. Any parent can tell you how important it is for children up to age 2 to take a nap. With babies, you always want to avoid the dreaded overtired state. And nobody wants to be around a 2-year-old who didn't nap. You'll never hear a parent say, "He didn't nap today," about a 2-year-old boy that is behaving well. Naps are a necessity. Unfortunately, around the age of 3, there comes a time when napping your child becomes counterproductive. It's not worth it. The nap during the day for a 3-year-old becomes a payday loan. For those of you who don't understand the connection, a payday loan is for people who can't seem to make ends meet until the next paycheck. So they go to a loan company, aka thieves, that will give them their paycheck amount early for a huge fee. This, of course, is unwise, and Susie Orman would be angry with you. It is equally unwise when applied to napping. If you take the payday loan of some free time by letting your cranky, drowsy 3-year-old succumb to the relinquished nap habit, be prepared that your child will be awake very late. When I say awake, I mean a nuisance to your life and sanity. This is the aforementioned huge fee that you now must pay. When I say late, I mean late. A 3-year-old with insomnia is very similar to a heroin addict going through withdrawal. There is nothing that calms them. They can't focus. You can't tell them enough stories. They don't understand why they are still awake 4 hours past their bedtime. This is commonly understood by all parents of 3-year-olds and has inspired great works of literature, such as Go the F to Sleep. Sure, while your 3-year-old naps during the day, you can get some work done, nap yourself, or waste time on the internet, but at what cost? Now it's payday, and you've squandered your loan on what? Checking Twitter? Somebody call Susie because you need advice. Once you've figured out the horrible consequences of the payday loan, you become obsessed with preventing the nap-weaned 3-year-old from napping in the middle of the day at all costs. This is not easy. They have napped all their life. They want to nap. They need to nap. You would like them a lot better if they napped. You feel that by keeping them awake, you are putting them through some CIA sleep deprivation experiment. It seems cruel, yet you find yourself dreaming up ways to keep them awake. You're nodding off at 4 p.m., time for a cold bath and a hot cup of coffee. Then comes the impossible task of enforcing nap prevention when your child is in the care of others. It's understandable that babysitters love napping children. "She was a delight," is always code for she slept for 4 hours. Jeannie and I have strict orders to not let Katie fall asleep. But why should the babysitter comply? They will never encounter the consequences of a napping 3-year-old. Now we are the naive cosigners that wind up footing the bill when the sitter defaults. The housing crisis could have easily been prevented if someone had simply explained the economics of napping a 3-year-old. Prepare for foreclosure on your evening because there's no bailout in sight. Get married, have kids, get fat. I'm getting fat. as I plan. Luckily, my gut is intentional. I'm actually preparing for a big roll. Sure, it's a cinnamon roll, but I want there to be room for it. Okay, fine, I could lose some weight, but I'm not going to hide behind some lame excuse. My paunch is no one's fault but my kids. I'm gaining weight, and I do blame my kids. I suppose that's the cliche, right? You get married, you have kids, and you get fat.